for the coming, while you also should not take further pictures of my beam ship, because the ones you have are fully sufficient. I gave you enough chance to get good photos, which become only doubted. Thus it shall suffice for the time, for it is neither our nor your mission to remove from doubters and criticizers their spirit-obstructing activities. The mission lies in quite other fields, as you well know. This alien's getting mad. This is when I tell girls, you're cute when you're mad. They calm down. Oh, now Meyer's going to start some stuff here. Oh, geez. Meyer says, this doesn't sound very kind, Semyasi. Oh, God. And it also disappoints me that I should not take further pictures. Oh, boy. This guy doesn't know how to handle women. During your absence, I have bought me a film camera because I wanted to get a movie of your ship. Oh, he said the wrong thing. Semyasi says, your disappointment pities me, but the status should remain. Still, I will admit you're using the film camera. It's a video camera. That you may be allowed to film my ship. But you are prohibited from doing this up close. And also, you may not get me on your film. But I will give you a short demonstration of my ship. Boy, that was smoothed over. I thought she was going to start a nuclear war. I still prefer my line. Did you know you're cute when you're mad? Okay, Meyer says, thank you, I could not film from near anyway. Else the camera will be destroyed. You had said earlier I could photograph your new ship up close. As you know, I tried this last contact, which failed because my camera, so to speak, exploded in my hands and fell, and the light measuring instrument and searcher were broken. I had to send it for expensive repair. Now Semyasi feels sorry for him. Did this really happen? I'm sorry, and I will make it up. That was not meant. Oh, the guy's playing the pity card. Hey, if it works, don't complain. In the ninth contact, which took place on Friday, the 21st of March, 1975, in late afternoon, the discussion turned to the purpose of these contacts at this time and the ET's view of present Earth humanity. Semyasi says, we are neither guardians of Earth beings, nor God-sent angels or similar. Many persons suggest that we are watching over Earth and her beings, and would control their fates. This is not true, because we only perform a self-selected mission, which has nothing to do with supervising or regulating Earth fates. Thus, it is wrong to expose us as super-terrestrial messengers and guardians. If we were such, we would regulate openly. So this is not true because Earth human goes his own evolutionary way. Surely he is barbarous and also impetuous in his research, and often unscrupulous. But barbarism is peculiar to many creatures, for it is natural conditioning and suited, thus life is assured. In this I speak of natural barbarism, which is not degenerative. Such is also the character of more developed beings than Earth man, and first ends at higher levels of spiritual development. It is not suited for Earth being to be degraded for this. He is a descendant of wild ancestors, and has to go the way of his evolution. This leads to misery and troubles toward cognition and knowledge. But this takes toughness and a certain barbarism, without which no inclination for a new, better future takes place. At first, a certain barbarism inspires research and development, because in this is strength to overcome confinements which obstruct progress. Earthman may recognize that he would not become liberated from sickness if life was not cut short by it, inspiring analysis of the sickness, germs, and the search for protective means. The risk in life for exploratory purposes is necessary barbarism which may be tolerated. Yet all kinds of evolution is barbaric, because that generates the necessary strength. A great danger is of scientists utilizing the power of their knowledge to beat their less developed fellow creatures into slavery and exploitation. Amen. From this they should be prevented, as well as their technical achievements, which only serve for destruction. It is not in any best interest their setting themselves up as gods, and by this transmitting the same mistakes their forefathers already did. These influences we want to prevent. Still, we want to encourage certain cognitions and show certain ways. And when we interfere in certain matters, that is only so the earth beings would not commit the same errors for which our forefathers so painfully suffered. Further on in the Ninth Contact, Sannyasi continues a chronology of Pleiadian recent history, begun in the Fifth Contact, where she described their migration to the star group we call the Pleiades. She resumes now with one of their earlier arrivals in our solar system and on Earth. This history, though clearly beyond all documented records, is not entirely implausible and may even shed some light on other ancient accounts of early history in our humanity. Other phenomenal works, such as O'Haspi by John Newbrow, hey bro, and Isis is Unveiled by Helena P. Blavatsky, have described some of this in varying degree before, but perhaps not as succinctly. Sannyasi, at our fifth contact, we ended the history of our mankind, where some 50,000 years ago in Earth chronology, our home worlds found peace and liberty. Shortly before this time, 70,000 human beings fled the Pleiades under the leadership of Pelagon. In spacecraft which they took by force, they fled through the cosmos and settled here on Earth. Under Pelagon were 200 sub-leaders, scientists, competent in special fields of knowledge. By these and others, Pelagon was unanimously acknowledged as King of Wisdom, IHWH God, and regarded as such. In the course of millenniums, they constructed great cities and inhabited all the continents of Earth. Regrettably, this went well for only a narrow 10,000 years until desires for power and control prevailed once more, and a deadly war raged all over Earth. Without exception, all was destroyed, and only a few thousand human beings survived on Earth, while others fled once more into the cosmos and settled on faraway worlds. For 7,000 years, none returned to Earth, and the humans left behind degenerated and became completely wild. Then descendants of those who had settled on faraway worlds returned. They were again under the leadership of an IHWH, under whose command they built on Atlantis and Mu. They built huge cities on each of the two separate continents. For thousands of years they lived in friendship and peace, until a few scientists were again overcome by the old thirst for might and power, and tried to seize the government. Don't we know about that? But having tired of wars, the nations rose against them, and they occupied spaceships and fled into the cosmic space, that being some 15,000 years ago in Earth chronology. For two millenniums, they and their descendants lived in a nearby solar system. Two millenniums during which they had become very evil, and only maintained order under strictest control. By mutation and their sciences, they extend their lifespans to some thousands of years. Overcome by their thirst for power, they left their world about 13,000 years ago and returned to Earth. Their highest leader was a scientist, Arus, A-R-U-S, who was also called the Barbarian. Like the IHWH 40,000 years before, he also had 200 leaders and sub-leaders who were competent in special fields of sciences. In the two groups, they settled in the High North and the present Florida of North America, while they continuously attacked Atlantis and Mu in wars. In only a few millenniums after their occupation of Earth bases, they succeeded in destroying the civilizations of Atlantis and Mu. The few survivors went into servitude, while many great scientists were able to flee and return to their homelands in the Pleiades. But centuries before this point in time, the intruders boasted of their conquest of Earth, and the IHWH Arus led a severe and bloody regime. Still, his subleaders assumed for themselves many things and became more and more independent. Within only 3 decades, they had gone far in their own decision-making. Even though they feared the punishments of the IHWHRS, they advocated a codex to, under all circumstances, maintain their own race pure and not allow it to fall to mutations away from themselves. In a forbidden manner and secretly, they went out and caught wild earth creatures and mutations who were distant descendants of former human beings from cosmic space. Wild and beautiful female beings were tamed and mated with the leaders, who called themselves Sons of Heaven. Each, according to his own race, created mutated beings, completely new forms of life, who were of dwarf-like stature, gigantic, or animal-like. Semyasa, the highest of the sub-leaders, mated with an Eva, a female being, who was still mostly human-like, and also rather beautiful in feature and form. The descendant of this act was of male sex and a human being of good form. Semyasa called him Adam, which was a word meaning earth human being. A similar breeding produced a female, and in later years they were mated to each other. Meanwhile, others similar had been produced, who forced groups and tribes. From these, present Earthman developed. IHWHME, angered by these activities, seized his sub-leaders when he could catch them, and killed or exiled them. In time, he changed his mind and recognized a new power he could exercise over the Earth beings. With newly appointed sub-leaders and guard angels, he brought 3 human races under his control. These were the ancestors of those who today are known as Indians, then the fair-skinned inhabitants who had settled around the Black Sea, and the third wave were the Gypsies along the south of the Mediterranean Sea, who were called Hebrews. Through his guard angels, IHWHRS subjugated those races and forced them under his control. As the highest ruler over them, he allowed himself to become venerated and adored. He allowed them to venerate him above creation itself, and his sub-leaders as assistant creators. He imposed harsh and severe laws demanding blood of the guilty. His son, Jehav, who took over his dominion, was little better, for he too, as IHWH, demanded only blood and death from the 3 enslaved races. The later descendants of these gods became more humane and developed a degree of spirituality. Their spiritual evolution changed their minds, and they decided to leave the development of the earth beings to their natural course and retired to their home world. So they left the earth and returned as peaceful creatures to the Pleiades, where their own mankind had reached advanced states. United, we live together today and are an allied population in peace and liberty. This is the essential that is important for earth beings to know. This was a stupendous statement and not altogether unsupported. There is evidence of other great deadly wars fought on earth, even using atomic weapons in our far distant past and almost inconceivably beyond our present age of science, which is actually less than 200 years old. The Takauti documents of Japan, which predate all other records there and all records in the Western world, going back 24,000 years in unbroken history, the foundation of Shinto, support these claims of earlier man-made atomic devastation of this world. The Takauti documents, on which the ancient Shinto teachings and the old Kojiki history are based, describe a great worldwide atomic war in that distant past and even contain maps showing the locations of each of the atomic blasts and the cities destroyed. The symbol on those old maps which marks the sites of the blasts is a mushroom-shaped cloud. The Hindu Mahabharata describes still another great world atomic war that occurred about 8,000 years ago, which wiped out whole nations and vast armies and left total and complete devastation. It was to some of these sites that Ascot took Meyer in a trip into the past to show him with his own eyes what man has done to himself. It is possible that the Pleiadians now visiting Switzerland feel that they have vested interests here, coming over from their own belligerent and often chaotic past, and perceiving yet another atomic devastation by the scientists' new ascendancy, a leg to us from their own history, now seek to head it off, if possible. In the last of that contact, Meyer was chastised for not getting this word out before it may be too late, and he objected that he was not a suitable one to do this, for which he was further rebuked, and then offered some help in an attempt to make it easier for him. The Pleiadians had indicated to Meyer that they could influence phenomena and could control events. They gave us adequate and convincing evidence of these capabilities on a number of occasions during our 8 years of investigations in this case. One time in Europe, on our way to see Meyer, we were picked up and taken to an interview with what we took to be a senior intelligence officer of a certain national government. Oh, I've heard this story before. This is good. During that interview, a multiple secured safe was opened and we were shown an object. Inside that safe at that time, on a top shelf laying flat, was a plain powder blue folder with an enclosure clip, and a signature sheet was fastened to the front. That folder was never touched or moved as we crouched in front of the opened safe. After viewing and inspecting the new object of interest, it was returned to a bag inside, and the safe was carefully closed and locked, and the piece of furniture disguising it was returned to its normal appearance. That interview lasted several hours, and then we were taken back to our hotel, which was kept locked and guarded by a watchman, and our rooms also were kept securely locked, and we were on a secure top floor. We got back around 12:30 after midnight and sat in Lee and Britz, also investigators on the Myers case, room for about half an hour, talking as Lee emptied his pockets and put his wallet, passport, and money on the top of a low wardrobe chest right there beside the bed. There was nothing up there at the time but what he removed from his pockets. It would have been impossible to have missed anything else on there. We finally turned in for the night, and Lee and Britt locked their door and went to bed. At 6:30 the next morning, I, having gotten up early, went to Elder's door to get him up for early breakfast and knocked. The door was still locked, and Lee got up and got his key and unlocked it and let me in while he got dressed. When Lee reached for his wallet and money on the wardrobe, he discovered for the first time that they were covered over by the big blue folder from the safe of the night before, lying just as it had been in the safe. Britt was awakened by our excitement and also observed the blue folder. Nobody had gotten up and unlocked the door since going to bed the night before. There had been no callers, and the mysterious folder on the wardrobe was only a few feet from the sleepers. Leaving Britt to guard the folder and get dressed, Lee and I went down to a lower level to a phone and called the officer. He was dumbfounded upon hearing of the blue folder and held the line open while he went to the safe and checked. Sure enough, the sensitive blue folder was in fact missing from the safe. He asked us not to touch it and said he would be right over. He arrived in minutes with a bodyguard and removed the folder after insisting on our assurances that we had not looked in it and asking us to promise not to release this fact for a safe time, which we have done. He was persistent in wanting to know how we had done this and wasn't quite satisfied with our answer that we did not do it. But this was just one of several incidents that made believers out of us and maybe him too. At the beginning of that meeting with that same gentleman in a special suite in the Grosvenor Hotel in London, the residence of several movie stars and facing Hyde Park, a similar phenomena event took place that made us begin to wonder who was really in control of what was going on. This is the story that I remember. There had been a build-up to this meeting with some previous contacts, so we knew where we were going and why. At the beginning of that first interview, we had been received and escorted into the suite used by that gentleman as an office. After that, we were taken into a secure room for our discussion and were just taking our seats. The room was a large one, like a living room, longer than wide, with a picture window at one side and a long sofa on the opposite. To the right of the long sofa was another door, with a big desk inside, more chairs and filing cabinets along one wall. In the corner to the right, in front of the long sofa, was an executive chair, a big overstuffed chair of black leather and fat arms. At each arm was a side table with a phone on it, white on one side and red on the other. The other seat in the room was a smaller sofa at right angles to the long sofa, and also facing the executive chair. The only other piece of furniture there was a large coffee table in front of the long sofa. I took a seat on the far right end of the long sofa, and Lee and Britt took the smaller sofa. We were both facing the big executive seat, and were invited to sit down, which we did. As soon as we were seated, and before any conversation started, the white phone rang 10 short rings. I was jolted with surprise, and I quickly looked at Lee and Britt, who were also looking surprised. Our interviewer had picked up the phone and was trying to get an answer, but apparently there was nobody on the line. Recovering, I asked the gentleman if his phone ever rang like that before. He said it was a strange ring, all right, as he was still trying to get an answer on the other end of the line, but now it clearly seemed to be dead. I suggested somebody is playing tricks, and he said he could find out, and dialed the operator and asked what happened to the call that just came through. He seemed to have been cut off, he said. No call? No light on the switchboard? Could anybody call in on this line without going through the switchboard? The board would light up and show it? No lights for this room. No calls into the switchboard in the last 5 minutes? Thank you. He cleared his throat and turned to start the conversation again, when the phone rang 10 short rings. He grabbed the phone and quickly answered it, as though he would catch the caller this time. Again, no answer. This time there was no mistaking the ring. Our interviewer said, I can't believe this. I'll get to the bottom of it right now. This is a direct line right to Telephone Central. It bypasses the switchboard downstairs and goes through no other operators. It is a secure line, and only especially cleared people can use it. He hung the phone up and then picked it up again, and dialed the Telephone Central operator. You did not call? No calls to this number. But the phone rang. You did not ring it? Nobody else can ring it? No calls came through. This is very strange. I thank you. Needless to say, our attention was not very well concentrated on the rest of that interview. Then we inadvertently sanitized our trial and lost the agents he had assigned to us. Not even knowing we had done it, he must have wondered indeed. These situations were only a few of more than a dozen such, of different kinds, which clearly demonstrated to us, with no shadow of a doubt, that the Pleiadians were aware of everything we were doing, as well as everything anybody else was doing that may pertain to them in any way. They alone knew who all the players were. We were able to identify only a few, incidentally. The total amount of effort by all must have been spectacular. We already had suspicions of the degree of involvement by others, mostly covert, and could easily see why and how Meyer had lost so much of his material. This broad interest was confirmed when a different agent of another country, called Lee, had made an appointment to meet him in a certain small restaurant. Lee decided to keep the appointment and see what this man might want. He was surprised to hear the man offer to exchange some of the information we had missed because of its disappearance from Meyer's control for copies of some of the materials we got to first, which they had missed in their collection efforts. We made a point of not documenting this background maneuvering because we were trying to concentrate on the facts of the extraterrestrial contacts as the phenomena under study rather than who else might be interested, which had already proved dangerous, and we didn't want any more of that. There is no doubt in our minds that some very unusual agency capable of some remarkable feats of magic was involved. And whatever it was, it had to do with our own investigation of the Pleiades contacts in Switzerland. The 10th contact in the afternoon of 26 March 1975 consisted of a long discourse on the nature of spirit, the God within, and its relationship with the all of creation. The fact that the spirit in man is the creator of its own destiny and man's contact with deity. This whole discourse sounded remarkably like the Ramtha dialogues, considering the fact that although the communicators in both cases said they originated in the Pleiades, they communicated to entirely different groups of people in different places at different times, all unknown to each other. They both described a non-personified creation consciousness that ensouls all, and in which all has its being. The creation consciousness is the sum of all its parts, and each part has equal access to the all. In effect, we are co-creators within the creation, and each has its own direct contact with its God self within. In that sense, each is a master of his own destiny and constantly creates his future as he progresses. The future of all is the collective of all the individual futures as they balance out.